Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome Andy Paris. He is a founding member of the Tectonic Theater Project and co-writer of The Laramie Project, 10 Years Later. And Akush Labastable joins us. She is performer and director, and she will be taking part in The Laramie Project, 10 Years Later, which is being performed on Monday, October 12th at the Lenzic on the 11th anniversary of the murder of Matthew Shepard, which is what the original Laramie Project was about, and this follow-up, which we'll be talking about. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's talk about the Laramie Project, the original Laramie Project, which happened almost 11 years ago. Well, in the year following the death of Matthew Shepard, a gay man, 21 years old, who was killed in Laramie, Wyoming. Tell us his story and how this theater project came into being.
On October 6th, 1998, Matthew Shepard was beaten in the outskirts of Laramie by two men who were also of his, they were his contemporaries. He was 21, they were 20 and 19. And for whatever reason, for many reasons, this made national news. There are many, many cases of violence against homosexuals and violence in this country in general that are not reported or don't get this much attention. But for some reason, this crime, this beating resonated with people. And it started to be broadcast across every news station in the nation. The town of Laramie was flooded with news trucks. And this became the story of the week. And one of the reasons it lasted so long is that he himself did not die on October 6th. He was found by by a biker, a mountain biker named Aaron Kreifels, who came upon him and thought he was just a dummy or a scarecrow.
Scarecrow, yeah.
That's the way he put it. That's what he thought he was. And then he said it was his hair that alerted him to the fact that it wasn't a scarecrow. And then he noticed the blood, and then he ran to the house and called. And a policewoman came named Reggie Flutie and found him and did whatever she could to keep him alive. And indeed, he did survive 16 hours being left in the cold, having been beaten close to death. And he survived for a week in a hospital in Fort Collins. So during that whole week, not only we were hearing about what happened to him, but also the nation and then the world was waiting to see if he would survive. And I think that helped keep the story alive, and this dialogue began to occur, that there were rumors that it was a hate crime, that he was beaten because he was a homosexual. And that sparked a big conversation in this country over hate crimes, over diversity, over class, because he was much more wealthy than they were. And that was part of the story of the crime. And a dialogue began to occur. And it began to be played out on every pundit's news station, CNN, MSNBC, Fox, etc. And what was striking was, as shocking as the crime itself was to everyone in the nation and us, a New York theater company, we were shocked by the events, and it resonated and struck fear and wonder into us as well. But what we started to find was the dialogue that was beginning to occur in the nation and on the news was, you know, a pundit would say, the Laramie Project, we're waiting to see what's going to happen to Matthew Shepard. And then we would have someone from Focus on the Family saying homosexuality was wrong, and then someone from GLAAD or someone saying this is why, you know, this happens, is that people speak, you know, all this language against homosexuality and that engendered. So you basically would have this very, you know, what they do with Democrats and Republicans, right? They polarize.
Right, exactly.
For entertainment, they polarize. They have one person for, they have one person against, and they duke it out. Also, during that time, Laramie was being portrayed as a backwards cowboy town where violence reigns and this happens all the time. And we were very unsatisfied with this kind of dialogue. We thought maybe there was more to this story. We were asking questions of why does this keep happening? Why did it happen in this town? Why is this happening across our country?
Namely, violence against gay people.
Yes. So we decided that because we weren't getting the information that we needed to maybe go and find out for ourselves.
Now, did any of you have any particular connection to Laramie or to this story, or just the fact that it was such a huge story that drew you in?
Yeah, well, it was partially that it was a huge story and the dialogue that was starting to occur in the nation, but also the brutality of the crime was shocking, and the details of the crime were shocking, and that this 21-year-old boy had to suffer what he did because he was a homosexual was shocking. And what motivated that kind of violence, that they would pursue that kind of violence? This is someone who was beaten, was struck in the head and the face 19 to 21 times with the butt end of a .357 Magnum over a period of many, many minutes. You know, hours.
After having been tied to a fence, so he was utterly defenseless.
Well, the first shot was actually given in the car on their way out there. So they started beating him, and they took his wallet while they were driving him in their car. And then they took him out of the car, and then they tied him up, and they were beating him the whole time. So this was an extreme amount of violence over a long period of time. And if it was motivated by homophobia, What does that say? What does that mean in terms of our culture and where we're living? And also the class aspect that he was obviously had more money than they did. They were that night buying pitchers of beer with dimes and quarters. And he was nicely dressed and was known to have money. Not that there weren't other people in Laramie who had, you know, who also
had money.
Well,
he was a college student.
Yes, he was a college student. And there is that aspect in Laramie of the town gown
right
thing. So it was shocking. It was shocking. The brutality of the violence was shocking. And then the dialogue that was coming out into the country about this thing that happened was shocking. And there are many reasons why people think that this made such a big story. One was the way he looked. He wasn't a black peer queen. He was this blonde, diminutive,
absolutely tiny,
bright-eyed,
100-pound...
Mm-hmm.
Young man.
That's right. And he didn't look like what was considered to be the typical victim of this kind of crime. That he was anybody's son. Blonde, bright-eyed, clean, really good-looking guy, young student. And I think that captured the nation's attention more than it would something else. Also, it was a slow news week. There wasn't much else going on. You know, all these factors kind of started engendering what we did have, which was this this uproar, this national uproar.
So you, the members of the Tectonic Theater Project, went to Laramie. Mm-hmm. And your intention, did you know before you started what you wanted to do?
What we wanted to do was find out for ourselves what it was like there. That's where we started. We didn't know yet if it would be a play, but we knew we wanted to find out more information. Like I said, what we were finding, you know, the press giving us was unsatisfactory to us. And we were interested in finding out for ourselves what it was like there. And finding out from the people who were involved, police officers, things like that, anything we could about the crime, and find out if what we were hearing was accurate. And all those, we had all those questions. So we had also just finished... The project that we were doing before this was a play about Oscar Wilde. And the play about Oscar Wilde was written from primary sources as well. It was written from biographies and autobiographies and his writings and newspaper accounts at the time. And we were asking a question as a theater company, how can a theater company or a theater be involved or play a role in the dialogue about an historic event? How can we tell that story that in a way that maybe a biographer or a newspaper person or a media person could not? What tools do we have in the theater to tell that story in a way that others don't? So when this happened and raised all these questions for us, we started asking the question, how can theater play a role in a current event? How can we use the tools of our trade to enter into the dialogue of all of the issues that were raised with this crime. So having said that, when we went, we had that question in the back of our minds. So we thought, well, how can we enter into the dialogue? We didn't know if that would be a play. We didn't know if it would be a series of readings, or we had no idea what it would be, if anything. We didn't know if anyone would talk to us. We didn't know what we would find. So we really went on basically a fact-finding mission. And very quickly, we found that people did want to talk. It was about 6 weeks after the crime, and the media had been gone for about a month. And during the time the media was there, they felt very defensive and very on their guard. And this was just about the time when they were really ready to start talking about things again. And we, having had no experience interviewing anybody, we were pretty green at this, and we were bumbling our way through it and really were very unprofessional and didn't know what we were doing. I think that was pretty clear to people. And I think it kind of put them at their ease, and you know, in the sense of like, okay, this is different than the media. This is not something that's going to end up in a 10-second soundbite on the 6 o'clock news. And that was really the fear. And we quickly allayed that kind of fear when they met us, and they started opening up to us. And we were also asking them questions about, hey, what's your life here like? What do you do for a living? You know, are you a native here? What was it like growing up here? Why did you choose to live here if you moved here from somewhere else? What's attractive about Laramie? Why do people want to live here? And I think that really, you know, and we were genuinely interested in that. You know, that wasn't just to sort of loosen people up. We really wanted to know a more complicated picture of what life was there, what life was like there. So that's what we started doing, was just asking people questions and trying to find anyone and anyone, you know, who would listen to us, you know, who would answer our questions.
And so the piece ended up being a portrait of a place as much as a story of a murder.
Right. What quickly evolved was that what we became very interested in and what the play ended up being about is what happened to the town of Laramie in the wake of the Matthew Shepard murder. And that's really what the first Laramie Project is about. Also, that, you know, they were building a case to prosecute these two individuals. There were legal proceedings happening all the time. So we quickly realized that we couldn't really delve into too much about the murder. This wasn't in cold blood. This wasn't. But well, I think in the end, even given the circumstances of the legal proceedings, I think that we wouldn't have chosen that anyway. That wasn't really what this was about for us. This was about finding out about the town and what they were going through and what people thought in the town and how they were thinking about this whole incident and, you know, what they were going to do in the aftermath of all this.
So you and the other members of the Tectonic Theater Project interviewed many, you know, a whole bunch of people from all different walks of life, all ages, all different relationship to the story. The interviews were transcribed and then edited. And I think the genius of this piece, of the original Laramie Project, is that it is so well edited and so carefully chosen that you build a drama piece by piece, slowly, through the exact words and often gestures and tone of voice, because you had seen them and had taped them, of these characters. And so the whole play is in the characters' own words, and their names aren't even changed.
Mm-hmm. A lot of them. Some of them are.
Oh, are they?
Some of them are where requested. We didn't think it was so important that everyone's name be exactly right. A lot of the names are indeed the same. But it did quickly become about the town, and what the play became is a town talking to themselves and having a community discussion about this. And that was really important to us. And it was important to us to make sure that whatever anybody said was really what they said. So when you're editing, you can do a lot to shape people's words. And we wanted to, you know, we are always checking back in with ourselves and making sure that, you know, is this really what they meant to say? And that was very, very important to us. And when we went back, you know, eventually we did perform the show in Laramie. And it was a real test for us in terms of making, you know, we didn't really know how it would be received or how people would think. And it was a really powerful experience for everyone, I think. Although it was a kind of a a dangerous situation for people because their words were being broadcast in a way they maybe didn't originally think they were going to. No one said that they weren't, you know, wasn't untruthful. Everyone said that's exactly what they said. And it was a very powerful moment for the community to hear back, you know, what their neighbor was saying, what their kids were saying, what their...
And even themselves, I mean, it's sort of the ultimate art is a reflection of life. Mm-hmm. I mean, seeing yourself and your words spoken in your gestures by another person has to be amazing.
Yeah, a wild experience, yeah. I can't say that well, now I have seen that happen because people play me in the show now, and I've seen other productions, The Laramie Project, but I'm not really saying anything of monumental importance in the play. I think for them it was a powerful moment, and for that relationship to develop. You know, we developed relationships with people over a long period of time. We went to Laramie. Writing that first piece, we went to back and forth to Laramie over a period of a year. So we got to know people, and then to sort of, you know, have them to perform for them in their words was a quite powerful relationship for both of us.
Now, the people got to know you, and many of them got to trust you. There were some who, at least at the beginning, didn't approve of what you were doing and said, "You New Yorkers, what are you doing coming in here?"
Definitely.
Did some of them change, or did you just... You were just not able to develop relationships with them?
Yeah, it varied. I mean, there were some people that were insistent that not only shouldn't we be there, but it should go away. That, you know, they're taking care of it legally, and that's the end of it. That
right.
There should really be no discussion beyond that. I'm not sure that we are going to be the people to persuade them that there is a discussion that needs to be had. But, you know, perhaps our work... Did I don't know. I mean, one of the reasons that we went back to Laramie this time was to find out that very thing, was to find out what had changed since then. And what we found was more of a question raised about how do you measure that change?
Right.
How can you tell if a community has changed? Is it in a law passed? Is it in a monument? Or is it that someone doesn't tell a homophobic joke that they otherwise would tell? And how do you measure that? How do you even know that occurs? Some people change their reaction to something without even knowing that they have. So whether definitely at the time we had a lot of resistance, as we did this time, some people came around once they knew what we were about. Other people didn't. I think, you know, the first time there was definitely a lot of, you know, at the end of an interview, there was, you know, you should really talk to this friend of mine who I know. And there was definitely a lot of that. And we kind of made our way through the community a lot in that manner.
So when you were first in Laramie and did this project and then performed it, how did you feel that the murder of Matthew Shepard affected the town, affected the people in it?
Well, again, you know, it's hard to encapsulate Laramie into one. You know, you can't say Laramie thought this or Laramie did that. And that's one of the really important lessons of this project, is that everyone has a story. And everyone's story is very important to them and to the people around them. And therefore is really important to our community at large. We are, you know, a makeup of everybody's story. And it's really hard to say what it did to people in general. But there was a great awakening, I think. I think there are a lot of people in Laramie who claim that this very incident, that this crime, that this thing that happened in their community changed them 180 degrees from what they thought before, from what they said before. You know, a great example is there were two officers, Rob DeBrie and Dave O'Malley. Dave O'Malley was the lead investigator from the Laramie Police Department in the crime, and Rob DeBrie was the lead investigator for the Albany County Sheriff's Department. So they worked very close together in investigating this crime. And part of the investigation of this crime was finding out, you know, who Matthew hung out with, who he knew, who he didn't know, and in general, how the effect of this crime, you know, what the effect of the was in the community of the crime, that was part of their investigation. And in finding out, in talking to people, they were talking to a lot of homosexuals, a lot of people in the community that they wouldn't have otherwise reached out to. And it was a real eye-opener for them about that people in their community were really scared and had been scared before this, and now were more scared because of it. And the things that they had to deal with about, you know, not telling people they were gay or only doing it in certain circles and being afraid to walk down the street in certain circumstances. And they were mortified. They had no idea that this was going on, and through the investigation of the crime, completely changed their tune about homosexuality, gender, about who needs protection in their community. And and they will tell you time and time again that this incident completely turned them around and turned their departments around.
I think also probably they found out that a lot of people in their community were gay who they didn't know were gay. Yeah. Was there quite a bit of coming out as a result of this?
Well, you know, I think that there was a little bit of both. There was a lot of coming out, and there was a lot of going back in.
Hmm.
Fear will drive you away. There were people moving out of town. There were people who wouldn't say that they were gay who otherwise might have. But then there were people who were coming out and saying, yes, you know, in order to combat this, we are going to have to be here. We were going to have to be very present. But that was a very brave thing to do at the time, because it was a hate crime, you know, and part of what a hate crime is it instills fear in the community at large, you know, of the person who was targeted. That's really what a hate crime does. So a lot of people were able to overcome that fear and come out, and some people not so much.
One of the things that I think is interesting in the original piece is an examination of this whole concept of live and let live. Some people said, oh yeah, there's a live and let live community, we don't really bother anybody. And the very fact of this crime showed that that was not always true. But there was a very poignant moment where a gay man who was interviewed said, live and let live is a bunch of bull.
Yeah, yeah. He said it's like the military. If I don't tell you, you know, I'm gay, then you won't beat the crap out of me. That's what live and let live was to him. And it's a very important point. It's very interesting, his transformation, though, because, you know, in talking to him this time, he said to us, you know, the last time you were here, I said this about live and let live. And although that's partially true, he said, since then, I have traveled all over the state with my boyfriend, who I met at the vigil for Matthew 10 years ago. And they are still a couple. And they travel around all over Wyoming, and they'll go into, you know, some motel in some basically isolated part of Wyoming. And the population in Wyoming is 500,000 over the entire state of Wyoming. So you get a lot of, you know, rural area. And he would go into these, you know, motels in the middle of nowhere, and they'd say two beds, and he'd say, no, one bed. And they'd kind of look at him for a second, and then they'd just give him the room.
Right.
You know, and he said, live and let live, and the libertarian attitude, you know, there is something good about it, and it does exist. But it should not be used to deny what also is there. So it's a very complicated idea, you know, that I think became more complicated for him in the 10 years since he said that. And that's part of, you know, what we capture in the Laramie Project 10 years later is, you know, people say one thing 10 years ago, and after some perspective, they have maybe something a little extra to say or something different that they learned over those 10 years.
What were some of the more dramatic or maybe surprising changes that you saw in the individual people whom you interviewed again 10 years later?
Mm. Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that what we noticed more than changes in individuals was the fight for change or the resistance to change. And that I think what happened to people during that time was really affecting for them. Like, for instance, Reggie Flutie, who found Matthew Shepard that night at the fence, she went through this heroic moment where, you know, the gloves, you know, that they used to, you know, broke. And since Matthew was HIV positive, she was exposed to HIV and had to go through AZT and all this, you know, stuff in the aftermath, and then eventually was found to be negative. But it was a heroic moment for her to take that risk, which you always take if you're not protected and there's blood.
And she'd been trained, don't hesitate. And then later people hassled her for...
Well, yeah, I mean, I think people do, people, I think that don't hesitate, I think that's what she says to us, is that she says, you know, just don't hesitate. I think that's her thought. I think that there were a lot of people who would hesitate. And she didn't. And that was, but, you know, it haunted her. It haunted her, that dealing with that kind of violence.
Yeah.
And in fact, in the years after that, she was put on a lot of those cases because she had handled it so well.
Right.
So she was put on a lot of violent cases, and it haunted her to the point where she had to quit. She couldn't take it anymore, all the violence. And she gave it up. As much as she felt like it was important what she did, and she loved what she did, she just couldn't do it anymore. And she went into retirement. Now she lives on her farm with her horses. But that kind of transformation in someone is important to recognize, that, you know, it doesn't just go away. It stays with people, and it haunts them, and it changes the way they react to any given situation. I think Jonas is a perfect example, you know, Jonas of change, of, you know, someone who came out pretty strongly in that, at that time where he wasn't really out in Laramie.
Jonas, the one
who talked about live and let live. And gradually has become more out and more out in his community, as well as his partner. Jedediah Schultz is a university student who was in the first Laramie project and started to go through his transformation, you know, at the time. But here's a kid who grows up in Laramie, and he says all the homophobic things. Grew up in a family that was Baptist, and definitely there was something in that congregation that was being preached against homosexuality, and he was growing up with that mindset, and that this incident really changed him around, really changed his tune, and he, as he said, it altered the path he was going down.
Now there was another whole set of thoughts about what happened. There was a fundamentalist, I hate to even call it religious because it was so mean and so homophobic, but there was the religious element in it that either felt that Matthew deserved what he got or really didn't have any sympathy for him. And then there was this whole question of what is a hate crime? Is there such thing as a hate crime? And that, some of those things came up in the first and the second Laramie Project, is that right?
Yeah. I mean, the religious aspect is what it is. I don't think that that's going to really change anytime soon. Now, having said that, there are individuals. For instance, one of the great heroes, I think, of the Laramie Project, the first one, was Father Roger Schmidt. He's a Catholic priest, right? But came out, and he was the one who organized the vigil for Matthew Shepard, you know, after he was beaten. He was the one who took the lead in the community to promote diversity and to take the lead in understanding this whole event, and to try to mitigate some of the defensive outcry that was happening because of the media onslaught in attacking Matthew and his character, right? So he really came out in a way of really truly loving your brother. Now, he also was the one who was counseling Aaron McKinney.
Aaron McKinney being the murderer of Matthew Shepard.
And he, you know, so he was really taking religion, I think, in its best light, in what it can do to support people who are in trouble. You know, and I think he didn't have to do that. And I don't think that was necessarily what the Catholic Church as an entity would necessarily even have him do. And that was a personal choice that he made. And I think that the people who are still preaching against homosexuality are still preaching against homosexuality. So I think religious institutions, I don't think any of them changed. Even though there were religious leaders who, and Sally Palmer is another one who was a minister for the United Church of Christ, who came out with Father Roger and was very supportive. So the religious aspect, you know, is, we found it to be quite similar to what it was. The range of people who are working is still the range of people who are working in religious institutions. And the question of what is a hate crime and is there such thing, that is even more present now than it was before. And that is one thing that we found that was shocking in Laramie that over the years, the rumors that had always kind of been there persisted to the point where people were real. The understood story in the town was becoming that it was a drug deal gone bad, or was a robbery gone bad, and had nothing to do with his homosexuality, and that every crime's a hate crime, and you know, if you kill somebody, you hate him. So, over the last 10 years, that has become more and more present, and so it was, and that was quite shocking to us. So we spent a lot of time talking to people, finding out where they got that story, who thinks that, and comparing that to the facts of the case that were presented in the trial, and finding out why there's such a discrepancy. And also talking to the officers to explain to us what a hate crime is and why it's different than any other crime. And that's part of the Laramie Project 10 years later. It's something we spend a lot of time delving into. And we talked to a folklorist named John Dorst, who works at the university. And he gave us a lot of insight into those rumors and what we as a society, sort of anthropologically speaking, do to adopt our own version of our history and take control of our own story when other people are trying to write it for us. And that rumors act as a kind of thread for us to follow to write our own story, right? So it's a lot easier for a community to say, oh, we have a drug problem, than it is to, oh, there's bigotry in our community. And that the rumors tend to support the drug, you know, oh, there's a drug problem, or, oh, there's those guys just needed money. And it allows people to distance themselves a little bit from, you know, the hate crime aspect of it.
Well, and the thing that I think is difficult is that none of us really knows what we have deep inside ourselves. None of us really knows what we're capable of. Mm-hmm. And so when you distance it that way, it's a way not to look into yourself.
Yeah, it can be. It can be. But also when you're put on the defensive, as Laramie was from the very beginning, if someone comes into your community, let's say someone comes into Santa Fe and says, you know, something happens here, and they say, well, Santa Fe is a bigoted community.
Right.
You know, your first reaction is, hey, no, it's not.
You're not from here.
You know, right. You don't know what it's like here. We are not a bigoted community. That's just not part of who we are. And that's a natural reaction for a community to have. And it's hard then to take a really good, nuanced look at any kind of underlying bigotry or hostilities that people have, because you don't get the chance to really examine that. Because you're busy defending your town, which is a natural response. So for Laramie, Wyoming, they have been the epicenter of homosexual rights since this has occurred. So they go to other places and they travel the country and people say, where are you from? And they say Laramie, Wyoming, and the first reaction of anyone they talk to is, ooh, Laramie, Wyoming.
Yeah, the place where they killed that kid.
Yeah. Oh, isn't that where Matthew Shepard was killed? That's a hard way to live your life, you know, and to be under the gun like that for so long. And it's a lot of pressure to live under. But of course, there are a lot of people in the community who go, I don't mind that because I get to tell the story again. And this story must live on. We must remember. So people have all kinds of reactions. But regardless, I understand it's difficult.
Now, were you able to talk to Aaron McKinney, the murderer who's languishing in jail in, what, two consecutive life sentences?
Mm-hmm. I didn't personally, but yes, as a company, there was someone in our company who spoke to Aaron McKinney and also someone who spoke to Russell Henderson, who was the second murderer. And actually, that connection, that really happened because of Father Roger Schmidt. Father Roger had, like I said, counseled Aaron McKinney, and they had a trust between them. And so Aaron really wasn't interested in talking to anybody from the media. And in fact, he's not supposed to. That's part of the bargain with his sentence, is they didn't pursue the death penalty. And one of the stipulations of that agreement is that he not talk to the media. And when he wasn't going to talk to us, but Greg Parati, who is one of the members of Tectonic Theater Project, who interviewed Father Roger and had kept up with him over the years, talked to Father Roger and said that we were thinking about doing this. And Father Roger was in support of it, and he said he would tell Aaron that we were going to try to contact him and that he should talk to us. And that was the reason why Aaron spoke to us, is because Father Roger said it was okay.
Certainly people can go to the Lenzig Theater on Monday, October 12th, and see the Laramie Project 10 years later. But I just have to ask you now, what did Aaron McKinney say?
Well, you know, we're still in the process of, and that's one of the, you know, obviously his interview takes great care, because just like any of the interviews, they're hours long and you really only have, you know, a very few minutes to present them. And so it's very important that you get the context right, and it's important that that he's represented the way that he would want to be represented. Because we're not trying to pigeonhole anyone, and we're really just trying to get people's opinions and people's thoughts and have it be their own. So we're still in the process of writing the play.
So this is really a work in progress.
It's very much a work in process. And so I can't say sort of blow by blow what he says in the play, because actually we're not sure exactly what's in and what's out at this point.
Right.
He does go into a little bit what happened that night, and he does, we do get to know him a little bit in the interview. Same with Russell Henderson. Yeah, you know, I will say that as far as it being a process, this is part of what Tectonic Theater Project does when they work on any project, is they'll do it over we'll do it over a period of many, many years. The Laramie Project took us 2 years. And during that process, we'll do a workshop, we'll put together some text, we'll read it in front of an audience, we'll get their feedback, we'll go back under, we'll do some more workshopping, do some more reworking and writing, we'll come back up and experimenting, we'll come back up, do another reading, get their feedback, and this goes on over a period of months.
And do you get audience feedback?
And we definitely get audience. We want the audience feedback. It really helps us and is part of our process. And I think it includes then our audience in the process of creating something that they want to see and they want to hear. And we're theater artists. We need the audience. And if nothing else, it creates even more of a kind of a community discussion. So we respond to that. I mean, we take criticism and take suggestions not with a grain of salt. So this is sort of a dream come true for our company, in the sense that, you know, we're writing this play. We sent out a draft of it in September to 150 theaters across the country, and we get to hear kind of what they think. And then we get to sort of rework it, and we're doing our own little readings in New York to find out, you know, what it needs and what it doesn't need. And so now
we Santa Fans get to put our two cents in.
And Santa Fe gets to put their 2 cents in, you know. And I think that when it's read on October 12th, it's going to be just another opportunity to get feedback from people about what they're hearing, what the story is that they're getting, and not just whether they like it or whether they don't. And we want to hear that as well, and we want to hear both, and we want to hear why someone likes it and why someone doesn't. But really, you know, what's the story they're getting? What is the most important thing that they think that they're hearing? What are we giving emphasis? What characters strike them the most? What are they missing in the story? All of these questions, you know, we're asking of our audience, which is now going to be an audience of thousands across the nation. And in fact, there will be an opportunity after the readings to Twitter questions to New York, and have us do a sort of a national Q&A after we've done the reading.
Now, you, by the time Monday rolls around, October 12th, you will be back in New York doing it there. Mm-hmm. And Akrishla Bastable has been sitting very quietly by, but she and a number of others will be performing it here. So you won't actually see what happens here, but there will be lots of collaboration through you, Akrishla, and the other people involved in the Laramie Project 10 years later, Santa Fe cast.
Mm-hmm. And I'm actually not participating as a performer myself in this, but I'm actually participating as a director in this. So I'm staging it for our Santa Fe version, and as Andy said, it's in draft format, which is very exciting, certainly for us as performers, as artists, and also just to see a piece in emergence, which it's sort of about, for me, about a sustained dialogue and about the company's endeavors to sustain a dialogue that I know for many people has been sustained, but sometimes just sort of lapses and And it feels to me like a bigger, that what's being addressed here is not just our, you know, our community's discomfort or whether they've come to become more comfortable around the issues of homophobia, but issues of difference and otherness. And so I really appreciate that the company's has opened it up, because it's a very brave thing to do, to open up your process when you know the piece isn't finished, you know it's not finished, and to sort of put it in other people's hands and just trust that they will respect the material and also respect that it is a piece in process. So certainly for me as an artist and as just somebody living in this community where none of these issues feel very foreign, to be frank, you know, it's a very human piece. The first Lamry project was the original piece is very well crafted. It's and it is a real testament to both the integrity of the company, but also it's a good piece of drama. And this piece is still, it's not as formed certainly, but it's a very, very interesting piece, and I think that people will find the interviews with both Russell Henderson and Aaron McKinney fascinating, because Andy was talking earlier about this sort of polarizing, you know, how we tend to sort of polarize opinion. And when you actually listen to them, you'll see a very different response 10 years later. The two boys have, or men now really, have very different responses to the crime of 11 years before. So that's been really interesting for me. And we're hoping to, we'll be connected to Lincoln Center, so it'll be very exciting. We'll be able to they can wave at us, but we can't wave back. And so that, I think that element, though, bringing it very solidly into the 21st century and creating this larger community will be fantastic, because there'll be the community of Santa Fe here, who we really encourage people to come out and to come and see this. And if money is an issue, if you want to come and see this, there'll be a way to come and be part of the audience, but also to be part of a bigger dialogue. And Tectonic has a blog. They have a number of ways that you can continue a conversation. And I think as artists, to engage in a dialogue that goes beyond just your sort of strict art form and engages in really current or actually encourages current dialogue rather than just sort of engaging it. It sort of encourages it. That to me is really fantastic. So I think it'll be exciting.
I think one of the things that the play, that the original Laramie Project does, and I'm sure this is just a continuation of that in many ways, is because the people in it are such a range of, some of them great people, but ordinary people. You, the audience, identify with the humanity of each one of them, mm-hmm. even when you disagree with their ideas. Mm-hmm. And you understand on a very gut level where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. And that creates a whole different kind of dialogue than the kind of screaming talking heads you get on the worst kind of polarized even talk shows, much mm-hmm. less news shows.
Mm-hmm. We try to be very conscious of our own point of view and make sure that as many points of view that as we found in Laramie can be expressed, and expressed in a way that is truthful to those ideas and not have it be recontextualized or judged in any way. It's very important to us that people get their say, because we can't really have a dialogue as a nation about a situation unless we know what people are thinking and really thinking and why they're thinking it and understand it. Only then can we start discussing those ideas and, you know, what we want to do about it.
There's a very big, important point in there, which is, it's not just the issues, it's the way you talk about them. And I've noticed that one of the things about hateful talk radio is that it really is effective in encouraging that kind of discussion, because I've seen people in real life talking like Rush Limbaugh. They adopt that way of talking, and I think in the same way, thoughtful conversation can also be encouraged so that people start imitating it.
Yeah, I would hope so. And again, not to necessarily adopt our points of view, but really to have a real discussion about it.
Exactly.
And to listen. And I think this is the act of doing this project, you know, for me, has been a real lesson in listening And again, what I said about, you know, finding out people's stories and finding out what people think and not just assuming they think something because of where they live or how they dress or what they look like or how they talk.
And that's something that, you know, it's not just as children that we're inclined to think like that way. I mean, I think as adults, you know, we make so many fast judgments about people. And so this, I found it very enlightening, these two partner pieces, just about, you know, the assumptions I make, because it's easy to, again, to sort of see people in extremes, but there's so much about what people say and that you can respond to, and that you understand that as part of, you could easily go there, you could easily think that. It's just a sort of, it's whatever environment that you end up in sort of cultivates your thought process too. So,
and the act of seeing people as human beings whom you can't fully categorize, I think, is a practice. Mm. It's something that you learn to do.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I mean, you know, and you also learn to pigeonhole people. I think that there's, you know, I think you're right that we are influenced by what we see in the media and what we hear in the media. We are very influenced by that. And, you know, so if you listen to a lot of Rush Limbaugh, you might start talking like Rush Limbaugh. I believe that. And so, you know, it's up to us to have the dialogue that we want to have. And that was part of the whole impulse of the Laramie Project was, we're not happy with the dialogue that's happening. We want a different kind of dialogue. And so this is what we're going to do.
Andy Paris is a founding member of the Tectonic Theater Project and co-writer of The Laramie Project 10 Years Later. Akush Labastable is a performer and director and part of The Laramie Project 10 Years Later, which is going to be on October 12th, Monday at 6 in the evening here at the Lensic. For tickets, you can call 988-1234. Thank you both so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR is streaming live on the web 24/7 at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.